From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A nearly 15-hour filibuster on the Senate floor now promises to bring up votes on gun control. Washington has yet to do anything bold. Is this the moment? Can 49 dead in Orlando do what Newtown, San Bernardino, Charleston couldn't? This hour On Point, after Orlando, a new push for gun control. You can join us on air or online. Where do you stand? What's your solution for the epidemic of gun violence? Stricter laws? Something else? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Karen Demergen, a Washington Post correspondent following the gun control debate in Congress. Karen, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane.
So Democrats ended this blockade, a nearly 15-hour filibuster on the Senate floor. Tell us what happened.
Well, there was a lot of talking about gun control, basically. This started at 11:21 yesterday morning and kept going until well after 2 in the morning. And it was an attempt to basically say that they wanted to demand having votes on these measures that have to do with gun control that do divide the parties pretty close to the party line. But they were demanding those votes, and then they said that they got an agreement early in the morning, said that they gave up the floor, and now we'll see what happens next.
Here's an interview with CBS This Morning Today. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, who actually launched this, said he believes the filibuster made progress and that Republicans would be compelled to act.
It would be much better to be able to get a bipartisan agreement on this issue of keeping guns away from terrorists, but at the very least, we have to have a vote. Senator Feinstein has fairly dramatically modified her proposal to try to address many of the concerns that Republicans have, and so it may be that if we put this measure on the floor for a vote, either at the end of this week or the beginning of next week, we may be able to draw enough support to get it passed.
So Republicans agreed to a vote, Karen, on legislation that would deny suspected terrorists from purchasing firearms, would also require universal background checks. I mean, give us some of the details here. What the Democrats want, what the Republicans want.
Well, Democrats want to actually get a vote that would pass these measures. Like you said, one of them has to do with giving the Attorney General the power to deny any suspected terrorist from purchasing a gun, for purchasing a firearm or an explosive, really. And then the other measure is to expand background checks and require background checks at gun shows and for online gun sales. These are efforts that, that at least the general topic of them, the Democrats have been pushing for a long time, but they homed in on these two things is what they wanted to this bill. Democrats clearly want to see a more robust vote for these things, but it's going to be subject to a 60-vote threshold almost assuredly, and that's going to be very difficult to achieve given the fact that there's very few Republicans in Congress who are willing to support these measures. On the question of the effort to keep suspected terrorists from getting guns, mm-hmm. they have due process concerns. They think that what if there's a mistake, that government makes lots of mistakes on these terror watch lists. If somebody is mistakenly, you know, raises an alert because they go to purchase a gun, would they be able to maintain their Second Amendment rights? And they're not comfortable with the fact that Feinstein says, well, if it's a mistake, you can sue the government.
So, aren't these basically the same proposals that California Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced, what, about a year ago, 2015, after the shooting in San Bernardino? I mean, you say the votes will be tough. What's different this time?
One of them is a Feinstein proposal. She's modified their proposal slightly, but it's basically, in spirit, the same thing. Only 45 people voted for it when it came up in December. That doesn't get you to 60 very easily,
right.
And it's the exact same people that are in the Senate now as they were then. So while there's a little bit of movement of people saying, we really have to do something, maybe our Republican alternatives aren't good enough, it doesn't mean that you've actually gotten to the point where you have 15 more Republicans coming on board, which is what you would need to be able to get this across the finish line. So Murphy was saying even last night on the floor that he thinks that the filibuster really did make a difference in terms of getting the amendments to be considered. But he even said that he doesn't know if that means that they'll actually get passed.
So here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell signaling on Tuesday that he may be willing to consider new gun control measures.
Nobody wants terrorists to have firearms. And we're open to serious suggestions from the experts as to what we might be able to do to be helpful.
So he's open to serious suggestions, he says. So where does he stand today?
Well, we're waiting right now to hear the official plan for what's going to be coming up on the floor and exactly when. It appears to be the Democrats are saying they have an agreement to at least get these two gun control measures presented as amendments to the spending bill that's on the floor now.
So, of course, this all comes a couple of days after the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, called for a moment of silence on the floor, and a handful of Democrats walked out. After the silence, an eruption of protests from Democrats. Here's a frustrated Connecticut Representative Jim Hines on the House floor Monday talking about the moment of silence for the victims of the Orlando massacre. He says Congress must do more than stand mute.
Silence. That is what we offer in America that supports many of the things we could do to slow the bloodbath. Silence. Not me. Not anymore. I will no longer stand here absorbing the faux concern, contrived gravity, and tepid smugness of a House complicit in the weekly bloodshed.
Our silence does not honor the victims of Orlando. It mocks them, he said. What's the mood in Washington, Karen, on this issue?
It depends on who you talk to, right? Everybody's very upset by what happened in Orlando. There's some Democrats who are very, very angry and want to see more done. You know, that walkout was a pretty significant thing. So was the filibuster yesterday. So you're seeing these displays of frustration as people are calling for these votes. But again, the question at the end of the day is, does it move the actual members of Congress to change what their votes have been on these issues? And there are some real, real points of conflict here when it comes to how they feel these things should be solved, as much as everybody wants to do something in the wake of the Orlando attack.
Will you explain to us what the so-called no-fly, no-buy list is?
No-fly, no-buy is a proposal, more so. It is a rhyming way of saying basically what is trying to be done in both the House and the Senate, which is to take people that have been flagged as suspected terrorists and to then say, you know, we don't want to have suspected terrorists be able to purchase a firearm.
And so, but the no-fly, no-buy would not have stopped the Orlando shooter, right? He was on a watch list, but he was never on a no-fly list.
Oh, right. But again, this is where the jargon does not necessarily always match with what's on the paper. I believe that in both cases, the actual list that they're referring to is the broader consolidated terror watch list and not just the no-fly list. So talking about the no-fly list, yeah, it seems like there's a disconnect because the Orlando shooter was never on a no-fly list. But if it's the greater consolidated watch list, or in the case of the Feinstein proposal, it's even broader than that. It's whoever the attorney general says is a suspected terrorist. It could have potentially caught the Orlando shooter. Again, it's impossible to know because it depends on would he have been considered suspected? And no, he was not any longer on a list. So the proposal that just sticks to the list in the House wouldn't necessarily have caught him, no.
Karen Demirjian with The Washington Post, really appreciate your reporting and your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Joining me now from Los Angeles via Skype is Adam Winkler. He's a professor of constitutional law and an expert on gun control and the Second Amendment at the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam Winkler, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So do you see anything different in the gun control debate in Washington this time around?
Well, just the fact that they're having a gun control debate in Washington is somewhat of a change. Since Newtown, things have been very quiet on Capitol Hill. But I think this Orlando shooting, just like Newtown, has really reignited the gun control movement and reignited the gun control debate. I think that the gun issue is primed to really be the central issue in the coming presidential election.
But is there anything really different in this particular debate? I mean, it seems like the proposals are the same. I mean, we have another massacre, Newtown. I mean, you could just list them. What is different this time?
I think what's different is that what's been going on in Congress over the last couple of days is a real effort to find out if there's a compromise position between the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, when universal background checks was debated after Newtown, it seemed that the two sides could not get together, and the things that defeated the bill seemed to be small things that could have been resolved with compromise discussions. It does seem like there is a genuine effort right now going on in Capitol Hill to find some compromise on this no-fly list. Whether it be successful or not, well, Capitol Hill is not great at finding compromises these days.
You write in the New York Times that according to an FBI report, more than 200 people on the terrorist watch list legally bought guns from federally licensed dealers. What are the objections, Adam Winkler, to banning people on the terrorist watch list from buying guns?
Well, it's a basic due process concern. We do have a right to have guns in this country, a right to bear arms, and none of our constitutional rights should be taken away just on the basis of government suspicion without involving, for instance, the independent judiciary to approve such things. You know, we allow the law enforcement to invade our rights somewhat when they wiretap our phones as a matter of law enforcement purposes, and we don't know about that. But generally, we recognize that there are due process protections. An independent court must approve it. And the law enforcement officers or the prosecutors must show that they have probable cause to believe there is wrongdoing. And those are the kinds of protections we do need for a no-fly list and a no-buy list.
But would a ban on gun ownership by suspected terrorists have prevented the Orlando shooting?
I don't think that's the right question to ask. It's not exactly clear. It does not appear that he was still on a terrorist watch list, so perhaps not. What the Orlando shooting should tell us is that, or remind us, is that guns can be an easy tool of a terrorist, and we should be doing more to keep terrorists from getting their hands on guns.
We've been talking about the no-buy list. It's been endorsed by both the Obama administration, was endorsed by the George W. Bush administration. How does the NRA stand on this particular issue?
Well, the NRA is not opposed to a no-buy list. They have just promoted a no-buy list proposal that is, in my view, a little bit ineffective and unlikely to work because the due process protections are too good or too extreme. You know, it's important to protect gun rights, but we also have to protect national security, and that's the balance we have to draw.
You have been writing a lot about Congress and Congress's lack of movement on this issue, but you've also talked about states' action, and you've written that many states have actually tightened gun laws significantly in the last few years.
That's right. There is a lot of movement in gun control at the state level, just not very much at the federal level.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, after the worst mass shooting in recent history, 49 dead, we're talking about what this country needs to do to end the gun violence. You can join the conversation. Is this country finally ready to do something about gun violence? What's the right response? Tougher laws? Better background checks? More sharing from the FBI? A lot of listener response here. Here are a few. Karen says, what's happening in Washington is a teeny tiny start in the right direction. Not enough, but a start. Thank you, Senator Murphy. Another here, I'm so happy that they're trying to do something. I wish the Republicans would join them because they're just as affected by this violence. This should not be a partisan issue. And all they'll do in Washington is put on a big show and come up with some useless regulations. Adam Winkler is with us. He's a professor of constitutional law and an expert in the Second Amendment at the UCLA Law School. Let me pick up, Adam, with what I asked you before the break about Congress may have stalled on passing gun control, but a lot of states have taken action. You've written about these tightened gun control laws in specific states. Tell us where that's happening and what's happening.
Yeah, I think about half of Americans live in states that have tightened their gun laws since Newtown. We've seen significant new reforms in California, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Maryland, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. Generally, these reforms have focused on restrictions on access to military-style rifles, so-called assault weapons, and restrictions on high-capacity magazines. We've also seen some states move towards universal background checks, sort of trying to plug the loophole in the current federal background check system. And I think this has really fed a real reinvigoration of the gun control movement, even as things are stalled in Congress.
You've also written about the demographics of the gun debate. Support for and opposition to gun control is closely associated with several demographic characteristics. Tell us about that.
Well, that's right. I mean, the NRA faces long-term the same challenge that the Republican Party recognized it faced after the 2012 presidential election, is that it needs to find ways to appeal to the changing and emerging demographics of the United States. We're having huge growth in the Latino/Hispanic population, growth in college-educated people, growth in people who are living in urban areas as compared to rural areas. All these things are pretty closely associated with greater support for gun control.
Here's some sound, a weapon of war that's been repeatedly used in mass shootings in recent years. This is some sound at an Adventure Outdoors gun shop near Atlanta this week after the Orlando shooting, an employee telling NBC News that they were selling more AR-15 semi-automatic rifles in 1 hour than they usually do in a single day.
Normally we might sell three or four a day, but we've been selling about 10 an hour, and then right around lunchtime, we were selling about 15 an hour.
Let's get two voices in here on both sides of this debate. Joining me from, Springfield, Virginia, Eric Pratt is Executive Director of Gun Owners of America. Nice to have you with us. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be with you.
Thank you. And joining me from New York is Brina Milikowski. She's the Chief Strategy Officer for Everytown for Gun Safety, a gun violence prevention group founded by former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Everytown has been working with Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey to restrict terrorist access to weapons. Welcome to you, Brina.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So, Eric Pratt, let me ask you first off here. When you first heard about Orlando, about the shooting there, about this killer then who bought his weapons, including an assault rifle, legally, what were your first thoughts?
Grief. We grieved tremendously over what happened in Orlando and the lives that were lost. And we think it would be prudent to listen to the law enforcement community as to what helps prevent these shootings from occurring. They actually encourage concealed carry by citizens. Now, first, what doesn't work, background checks. The killer passed multiple background checks to buy his firearms. Secondly, gun-free zones. The killer ignored them. Everyone in that bar obeyed the gun-free zone law except the killer. It's interesting, when you look at all the public mass shootings in this country, over 98% of them occur in these criminal safety zones where good people are barred from carrying firearms. Killers prefer gun-free zones. Now, the law enforcement community says 86% of police say that the way that you avert these mass shootings is by utilizing concealed carriers because they're the real first responders. You know, it's interesting. A year ago this month, there was a mass shooting attempt in an Ohio bar, but that one ended much differently because an employee at the bar had a concealed carry permit and shot the guy several times, killing him, and thereby saving everybody's life. No innocent life was lost. And as you look around the country, you see many examples of that. In a hospital in Darby, Pennsylvania, another mass shooter stopped in his tracks, at a barber shop in Philadelphia, at a church in Orlando, Florida, on and on and on. You see that mass shooters are stopped by good guys with guns, and that's what the police are actually advocating.
And so, Brina Milikowski, what's your response to that?
First of all, background checks work when the right laws are in place. The background check system has stopped more than 2.5 million felons, convicted domestic abusers, severely mentally ill people from buying guns. Background checks were not able to stop the Orlando shooter because we have a gaping loophole that's a national security threat in our law where suspected terrorists can't be blocked from buying guns. If the Feinstein proposal, which hopefully the Senate is going to vote on today, was in place already, it seems that the Orlando shooter would have actually been prevented from buying his weapons of terrorism.
Well,
second, I'm not sure where Eric is getting his facts, but we look at all mass shootings that the FBI qualifies as a mass shooting, which is four or more fatalities. We've looked at every single one since 2009, and the vast majority of them actually occur in private residences. And of those that do occur in public, the overwhelming majority of those occur in places where it is legal to carry firearms. You know, our public conversation about mass shootings is not always entirely accurate. The fact is 57% of them are actually incidents of domestic violence. And while the gun lobby is trying to sell the notion that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy and a gun, the fact of the matter is laws work and public safety measures that will keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people in the first place is the right common sense measure that most Americans are calling for.
I think Brina, let me put this to you. I think Eric and others are saying that this is a slippery slope, that if you start restricting one thing, then what's next?
Jane, with all
Brina, let me ask Brina to respond to that. Brina, go ahead.
I appreciate those concerns, and I would say that with rights come with responsibilities. And I support the Second Amendment, but I understand that our Constitution is not a suicide pact. It's a framework for creating a balance between individual liberties, public safety, and an environment in which all Americans can be free to live to their greatest potential. In our current system of laws, there are gaping loopholes that make it far too easy for convicted felons, suspected terrorists, repeat domestic abusers to easily access guns, even though public safety and data shows that they have very likely they're very likely to commit dangerous, mm-hmm. lethal mm-hmm. acts with those guns. And that's the public safety threat that we have to balance here.
And so, Eric Pratt, let me ask you this. A lot of people want to understand why a civilian ever needs to own an assault rifle. To that, you say what?
Well, first, I'd like to address an earlier point, and that is it is absolutely true that most of the massacres, public massacres, are occurring in gun-free zones where the killers bought their guns legally. San Bernardino, the Oregon Community College, Charleston, Chattanooga, both Fort Hood shootings, the Aurora shooting, the Navy Yard shooting, Sandy Hook, and Columbine, all of those were gun-free zones. We see this over and over and over again. Now, to your question, about semi-automatic firearms and who would want to own one. First of all, I would say it's an offensive question because we have a Bill of Rights, not a Bill of Needs. So to say, why do you need to exercise? Heck, why do we need to meet in bars? If we banned bars, you wouldn't have had that killed, nor would you have had the one that occurred with gasoline and matches in 1990, where Julio Gonzalez, using matches and gasoline, killed 87 people. Now, obviously, that's an absurd question to start going down that road. We have a Bill of Rights, which says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So your question involves an infringement. Now, why do people own them? They own them for self-defense. Look at the Los Angeles riots. Look at Hurricane Katrina. People use those types of firearms to defend themselves against roving gangs, against rioters. In the Los Angeles riots, it was the Koreans that were defending their stores. Their stores didn't burn down, whereas other stores around them did that were left unprotected.
And so, Adam Winkler, do we need assault rifles for self-defense?
Well, these weapons are not typical self-defense weapons. They can be used for self-defense, like just about any firearm, but it's typically preferred by people for hunting and sport. The vast majority of owners don't use them primarily for self-defense. I will say that I think that regulating assault weapons is sort of the wrong focus. These weapons are generally not used in criminal activity, and while they are associated with some high-profile mass shooters, most mass shooters just use handguns. And I personally don't believe that in Orlando things would have been fundamentally different had he had several handguns rather than his assault rifle. My view is we shouldn't be focusing on a particular kind of gun. There are so many easy substitutes. If we want to reduce gun violence, we have to keep the bad guys from getting any guns.
A lot of calls want to get in here. Let me get a listener in here, Eric. Hold on. Nicholas in Medford, Massachusetts. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just want to frame the discussion here.
Okay.
On one hand, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. On one hand, we have what many refer to as a crisis of these mass shootings, and on the other, we have sets of proposals each to restrict the ability of certain people to buy guns. Do we have statistics to look into the number of, especially even prior incidents, that each of these proposals would prevent? In other words, for the real-world crisis we face right now, how effective are each proposal at reducing these incidents of violence?
That's a good question, Nicholas. Adam Winkler.
Well, we don't know exactly. Of course, we've never sort of operationalized these principles in the, for instance, the no-buy list to try to figure out whether it would have a significant effect. Part of the problem is, with regards to gun control more generally, is that there's just not that much research on gun violence prevention and what kinds of gun control laws work. One of the reforms we really could use is to free up the Center for Disease Control to finance studies, even if those studies might show that gun control laws could work. Currently, we have the NRA and its allies in Congress have really shut down the spigot of federal money that really provides public health research and would give us more information so that we could make good and effective gun control laws that don't interfere with people's right to bear arms.
Let's go to Medina, Jane, Ohio. Elaine is on the
Jane,
line.
Can I just
hold on one second? Let's get Elaine here. Go ahead, Elaine. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My question is, since the NRA only has 3 million members, which is almost less than 1% of the population of the United States, why do they have such a stranglehold on the Republicans in the Congress, since this seems to be such a bipartisan issue? The other question is, we've done the assault ban before, 1994, we just let it expire. Why can't we do it again? It just seems ridiculous from the people I talk to in Ohio, the Republicans in Ohio, that we don't have a better grip on this problem and don't solve it.
That's Elaine, thank you. Brina, I'll let you answer the first question. Why does the NRA seem to have a stranglehold on Republicans? Elaine wants to know.
That's a great question, and I would put it in a bit more historical context and say, until recently, the NRA had a stranglehold on both parties. And even if you look at the incredible leadership of so many Democratic senators last night in the filibuster, several of them had been NRA A-rated until very recently when they finally came around and are really standing up and leading on this issue. I think the absence of a strong voice and a counterweight for much of my lifetime, at least, gave the gun lobby outsized power and gave them a false sense of gave elected officials a misunderstanding of where their constituents are at. But we've seen a sea change in energy and advocacy and visibility and engagement on this issue. We at Every Town Alone have more than 3.5 million members in all 50 states who are calling their members of Congress, who are visiting state houses to lobby for common sense gun laws. And we're just part of a growing movement that is putting, you know, proof of concept to the poll after poll that we've seen that the common sense solutions that we're advocating for are overwhelmingly supported by voters. We've seen Democrats get the message. At the state level, we've been able to make progress with bipartisan support of many proposals and Republican governors signing common sense gun laws in a few states in the last few years. So I'm confident that in the next few years, we're going to see both more and more people from both parties stand up and lead on this issue.
Eric Pratt, I'm going to get to you in a minute here. Let's play this sound from West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin defending America's use of the AR-15 assault rifle.
I know with the AR-15 that you're talking about and the type of weapon and what it's used for, you know, the people that go hunting, and we don't use that type of a gun, but there's an awful lot of people that do collect, and they do go sports shooting. And they use it for a very legitimate, very legal way.
Very legitimate, very legal uses for the assault rifle, Eric Pratt. I mean, 57% of Americans, however, say they support a federal bill that bans assault weapons outright. Your response?
Well, first of all, I'd say there's conflicting polls on that. But irregardless, the beauty of having a constitution is that it trumps whatever the opinion polls say. If a majority wants to ban certain speech or if a majority wants to support slavery, the constitution trumps those views. And so, we're a country that loves to be guided by polls, but really it doesn't matter when you have in your highest law something that says that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, in regard to these firearms, you know, the word assault weapons has been thrown around, but actually there is no such thing. The New York Times admitted last year that it was a Democrat-invented term. There's no army on the face of the earth that uses AR-15s or the six-hour that the killer used down in Orlando. The New York Times said that it's never been the weapon of choice. In fact, more people are killed with knives and baseball bats and hammers. And the Times also said that the ban was ineffective. It's interesting that since the ban expired in 2004, we are actually safer today. Those guns are once again legal. And our murder rate has gone down 20% since 2004. So we're actually safer today with those guns being legal.
Adam Winkler, is that true?
Well, I don't think that there's any evidence to tie our current law with on assault weapons with the drop in the homicide rate or the drop in the crime rate. I know of no studies that control for other variables to make that causal relationship clear. But it is true that these weapons are used only infrequently in criminal activity. Most criminals just prefer handguns, and most gun violence really is handguns. That's why I think it is more important to focus on things like universal background checks, on a no-fly/no-buy list. What we want to do is everything we can to keep all of the guns out of the hands of the bad people. And whether a law-abiding person has access to an assault weapon, even if it sounds bad and it sounds dangerous, probably isn't much a much greater danger to the public.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the new push for stricter gun laws after the Orlando nightclub shooting. And you can join the conversation. What are the gun laws in your state? Do they need to be stricter or not? Here's Florida gun dealer Ed Henson of the St. Lucie Shooting Center, which is a range and gun shop not far from where the nightclub shooter lived, saying that he did everything by the book when he sold the shooter a handgun and a rifle. Here he is on Monday at a press conference.
An evil person came in here and illegally purchased two firearms from us. And if he hadn't purchased them from us, I'm sure he would have gotten them from another local gun store in the area. This man held multiple security licenses. He had an armed and an unarmed license. He passed a background check that every single person that purchases a firearm in the state of Florida undergoes.
Joining me this hour, Eric Pratt, the Executive Director of Gun Owners of America, Brina Milikowski, an Everytown for Gun Safety Director, and Adam Winkler, a Second Amendment and Constitutional Law expert at the UCLA School of Law. Brina, you hear that gun dealer, that shop owner saying, here the shooter, you know, purchased these legally. He had multiple security licenses. He had an armed and an unarmed license. He passed a background check. What more do you need?
To me, that's a call for the kinds of common sense proposals that the Democrats in the Senate have been staying up late for last night. You know, the Orlando shooter is one of more than 2,000 people that the FBI had under investigation for suspected terrorism who legally bought guns in this country in the last decade, because the FBI does not currently have authority to block sales to people known to be engaging in acts of terrorism or suspected of doing so. And the Orlando shooting was just the sixth mass shooting in the last few years to be investigated by the FBI as an act of terrorism. So I think it's high time that the Congress close the terror gap loophole. And more broadly speaking, to Adam's earlier point, universal background checks will also have will go a long way in making sure that we're not making it so easy for dangerous people to buy guns and illegally traffic them on our streets. And we know this is going to work because in the states that have already closed this loophole and do require criminal background checks for all sales, there are 46% fewer women shot to death by intimate partners. There's 48% fewer law enforcement shot to death. There's 48% less illegal gun trafficking. Mm-hmm, you know, we've got a crisis with hundreds of thousands of Americans dying from gun violence in the last few years alone. And we've got solutions on the table that we know could help cut some of those numbers in half.
Let's get David in here from New London, Kentucky. David, glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I own an AR-15. I use it for target shooting, fun shooting. My kids have hunted with it. They've killed deer with it. It is my primary home defense weapon. I also have semi-automatic pistols. And what kills me about this whole discussion about the Orlando issue, mm-hmm. it is very obvious that the shooter in Orlando was very, very motivated. Very motivated. Was willing to murder 100 people, did murder 49. And it kills me to hear these conversations that, oh, we need one more law and it would have stopped this guy. No, it wouldn't have. This, a person like that is going to keep pushing, and that's what they do. But it's not going to, he's not going to go, oh gosh, it's illegal for me to buy a gun. Oh, I guess I won't go kill 100 people because I'm in love with ISIS. And these conversations are just ignorant sounding. Anyway, thank you.
David, thank you. Brina Milikowski, you know, doesn't matter the guns, doesn't matter the weapons, it's the motivation.
You know, I'm with everyone this week feeling shocked and outraged and upset by the level of hatred and evil out in the world. And, I'm an attorney myself and a pragmatist, and I would never say that one law is going to stop all crime or prevent all future acts of evil or war or terrorism. But I also firmly believe that laws work, and that public safety measures that are data-driven and evidence-based can make a strong impact on protecting our communities. And I do think that the American people deserve a government that's willing to do everything that they can to protect our national security, to protect our communities, and to protect our families. When we're facing 91 Americans dying every single day from gun violence in this country, I think we have to take every action that we can to see what we can do to stop this crisis.
David, glad you called. I've got some listener comments here for you, Eric. Jeff says, good guys with good guns don't need AR-15s. Wanda says, I gave up after Sandy Hook. If 20 dead babies are not enough, nothing is. James says, I'm an off-duty police officer working an off-duty police officer was working at the Orlando nightclub. He was outgunned. Gun against gun didn't work there. And Ben says, America has half of the world's guns. By Eric Pratt's logic, we would have by far the safest country. To all of that, you say what?
Actually, the United States is not even in the top 100 when it comes to murder rates. And the nations that are in the top 100 all have much stricter gun control laws than we do. One of the things that is being ignored here is that we only focus on firearms after a tragedy. When Obama commissioned the CDC in 2013 to study firearms, it found that there were anywhere from 500,000 to 3 million cases of self-defense every year, which means when you bounce that against the number of tragic deaths, that means guns are being used in this country 16 to 100 times more often to save life than to take life. And that's why, like, all those mass shooters that were stopped at the hospital, at the barbershop, at the church, on the Chicago street corner, at the gas station in Louisiana, those don't get played in the media. And so people don't hear about them. And so the only time that if they're not in a gun community where they have friends or family that enjoy shooting firearms or keeping firearms for self-defense, then the only time they hear about a firearm is after a tragedy like this. And they're not hearing the many, many more good cases where firearms are used to actually protect life.
Eric, thank you. Adam Winkler, what do you hear here?
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is guns are sometimes used effectively for self-defense. I don't think there's much doubt about that basic question. The question is whether we can have good laws in effect that don't interfere with individual self-defense, but still allow us to do more to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. You know, the truth is the kinds of reforms that we're talking about are not going to disarm the American public. We're talking about universal background checks. You want to buy a gun, you can buy a gun. Just go through and make sure that your system, that your information is run through a system to make sure you're not a bad guy. That's not a significant burden on gun owners. And a no-buy list, this is a slightly greater burden, I have no doubt, but the procedures will be put in place so that someone could challenge their determination that they're on the list, and it's expected to affect a grand total of 200 people a year. So the idea that somehow we're moving towards a society where people aren't going to be able to defend themselves with firearms just seems silly to me.
Here are protesters in support of the assault rifle ban standing outside the NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia this week. Here's one man expressing that the right to bear arms does not extend to assault weapons.
We need the assault weapon ban to be back in place. We need to keep these guns off the street and unavailable. We're not talking about hunting rifles. We're not talking about your basic guns that you need for protection. That's all fine and good. We all support that. What we don't support is literally weapons of mass destruction. 49 people killed in a matter of minutes.
Adam Winkler, take us back. Help us understand the assault rifle ban from the 1990s. What motivated it? What motivated Washington to regulate assault weapons back then? Who was behind that effort, and what did the proposal seek to do?
Well, there was an effort to ban assault weapons, and it was really inspired first by a shooting in California that had involved one of these military-style rifles. And so California pushed to ban assault weapons, and that caught on and was enacted at the federal level. The difficult thing with the assault weapons ban is that it's hard to define exactly what an assault weapon is. Eric Pratt was right that there is no just clear category of assault weapon. So what you do is you tend to define a particular set of rifles by certain characteristics that seem especially military in styling. However, the gun makers just made the exact same guns with the exact same lethality, just without those offending military-style features, and sold them by the millions. And we still have that in California. We have the most restrictive assault weapons ban in the country, and you're still able to buy essentially the same weapons with just little gimmicks put on them so that they avoid the regulation. The problem with banning assault weapons is it's a little bit like saying we want to reduce drunk driving, so we're going to ban scotch. We're going to ban one particular kind of alcohol that we think is contributing too much to this kind of violence. When there's so many easy substitutes, you can't really expect that's going to result in a significant drop in criminal activity.
So there's a law still on the books, Adam Winkler, called the National Firearms Act, passed back in 1934, days of Al Capone, Bonnie and Clyde, and all the rest. What did that law do? Was it effective?
That law was effective. You know, for everyone who says that gun control never works, they seem to forget what happened in the 1920s and 1930s. In the 1920s, every self-respecting criminal who could afford one got himself a Tommy gun. It was the first civilian accessible machine gun. Al Capone had this, John Dillinger had it, Bonnie and Clyde had them. They had these Tommy guns. And the National Firearms Act was enacted to impose a strict licensing system on on anyone who wanted to own a machine gun. And now we find today that as Gun Owners of America and other organizations will be quick to tell you, machine guns are almost never used in criminal activity today. Why? Because it's very hard to get your hands on a machine gun. Machine gun owners are heavily watched and regulated by the federal government through a licensing scheme. And as a result, these guns are not used in crime. So gun control can work.
Let's go to more calls here. Gary in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air, Gary. Welcome.
Thank you. A couple quick points.
Okay.
The gun owner gentleman is correct. The type of weapon really doesn't matter. What really should matter are the waiting periods. You need extended waiting periods because anyone who needs a weapon now is a person that shouldn't get a weapon now. And additionally, when they talk about the Second Amendment, these people always forget the first four words, a well-regulated militia. So if you show me what militia you belong to, I'd be glad to let you get whatever weapon you want. And that's it for me. Thanks.
Gary, thank you. Let's go to Matt in Austin, Texas. Hi, Matt. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My
go ahead.
My comment is also about the Second Amendment. When it was added, the rate of fire for the state-of-the-art firearms at the time was probably 3 rounds a minute. And today, when you can fire off hundreds of rounds a minute, I don't think that they would have added the same kind of verbiage to allow anybody to own any type of weapon. That's my comment.
Are you a gun owner, Matt? Do you own weapons?
I do. I have a shotgun and a rifle, but I'm not a member of NRA.
All right, Matt, thank you very much. And here's Celeste in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Celeste, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thanks, Jane. Mm-hmm. I've always been opposed to these kind of weapons. I don't understand why people feel they need to have them other than they think they're fun. But if we did have a ban on certain types of assault rifles, how would we get them back? How would we get them collected and out of people's hands? People are not going to turn them over. What's the procedure? What would that be?
I hear you. Adam Winkler, do you know?
Well, there's really no effective way to get them back. And I don't think anyone is seriously talking in Congress these days about outlawing the possession of these weapons. They're talking about outlawing the sale of them. So if you have one, you'd probably be able to keep one. We don't know who has these weapons. There's no registry of firearms. So there'd be no way to know exactly who's got them. And part of the problem with these gun control proposals, if we ban possession, is that we find high rates of noncompliance. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sunnyvale, California have all banned the possession of high-capacity magazines. And what we found is that virtually no one is complying with those laws.
We've got a couple minutes left here. Eric Pratt, I want to read you this piece of this editorial from the Boston Globe today. It is shocking that a democracy as mature as ours is fundamentally unable to have an adult conversation about guns, as if the Second Amendment has sentenced us all to the unending argument about how many angels fit on the head of a firing pin. Do we need, Eric Pratt, to cut back on our long-held belief about gun ownership to meet the realities that we face today?
Well, it's interesting. They say they want to have an adult conversation, but then they only want to have that conversation after there's a tragedy. It would be like saying we're only going to talk about doctors or cars or swimming pools when after doctors accidentally kill somebody or there's a car crash or a child drowns. I mean, you know, if you only talk about something in the negative, then that's not really having an adult conversation. An adult conversation would be, okay, let's talk about all these cases, which Obama's Center for Disease Control found 16 to 100 times more often guns being used in self-defense. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, one caller said we need waiting periods. Well, you know what? Let's talk about Carol Bound in New Jersey, who is dead because she was waiting through a waiting period for her firearm to protect herself from her former boyfriend who was violently threatening her, and she got security cameras, she got a restraining order, and she feared, you know what, that's not going to be enough. I'm going to need a gun because he's going to attack me and kill me. Well, she was waiting 47 days to get permission to buy a firearm in New Jersey, and sadly, he showed up on the 47th day, stabbed her to death. He didn't need a gun, but she did.
I want to get Brina in for a last word here. You're Chief Strategy Officer, Brina, for a gun violence prevention group. Is your strategy working? How do you change hearts and minds today?
our strategy is absolutely working, and you can see that in the hundreds of thousands of Americans who have come out this week asking Congress to take action, and they are turning out in their own communities, talking to their elected officials and demanding some action. I'm with Eric that we should be having this conversation every day, and that's because we have a gun violence rate that is 25 times that of other developed countries. And every single day, not just in the aftermath of the horrible Orlando shooting, we should be acknowledging the public safety threats that we're living with, and that we can have an adult conversation that's true to our constitutional values and our constitutional history, because if you go back to the founding, even since the Second Amendment was drafted, there's always been smart local regulations that promote public safety while also ensuring self-defense and individual rights.
I appreciate so much the panel today. Brina Milikowski, Chief Strategy Officer for Everytown for Gun Safety. Brina, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eric Pratt, Executive Director of Gun Owners of America. I appreciate your perspective, Eric. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane, very much.
Thank you. Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at UCLA, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, thanks for giving us some perspective.
Thank you for having me.
And you can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.